and Norm Shealy.
NormShealy.com.
You are listening to Infinite Consciousness, your infinite access to the world
of the mind.
Welcome to Infinite Consciousness tonight, and thanks for listening. This is Eva Herr, and tonight I have with us Dr. Rick Hansen, and we're going to talk about his book, The Practical Neuroscience of Buddha's Brain. How are you, Rick?
I'm great, and if I could, the title's actually Buddha's Brain, The Practical Neuroscience of Happiness, Love, and Wisdom. Lots of people say it differently because of the way the cover design is, but the title itself is Buddha's Brain.
I'm sorry. My book on my cover, people do the same thing. I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah.
So before we get started, can you tell us a little bit about you and how you came to be where you are today?
Well, that's a long story. I'll give you the short version. So I'm middle-aged, went to college in the early 70s, got into the human potential movement. That was phenomenal for me personally, and also I worked in that field for about 10 years. And then as I edged into my late 20s and had a child and was looking at my 30s, I figured I really better go get to grad school or something. So I studied developmental psychology, then clinical psychology, then neuropsychology along the way. Got a license about 20 years ago, and the rest is history. Along the way, starting in 74, I began meditating. I got introduced to the Eastern spiritual traditions then. They rang completely true to me immediately, having been raised a kind of casual Christian in the suburbs of L.A. And in the last 10 years, I've been really focused on bringing together the breakthroughs in science about the brain, which are just exploding every week with new findings, and bring those findings together with ancient contemplative wisdom. And then on the basis of that, turn that into a toolbox that regular people could use in the middle of daily life to use their mind alone to change their brain, to change their mind for the better. I should add that I've been married nearly 30 years, got two kids, 23 and 21. My first book was about taking good care of mothers and couples over the long haul, how to actually do that. And I've been a business consultant, too. So I'm definitely have had my feet in the real world.
Can you speak just a little bit louder? I heard all of you, but I'm, like, struggling just a little bit.
Oh, sure. I can put it out. I'll use my camp counselor voice.
Thank you.
Get out of the pool. All right.
So where can people find you?
Oh, BuddhistBrain.com will take them to my website, and it's chock full of free resources. Many, many talks I've given, over 100 articles, slide sets from workshops, all freely offered. People are welcome to take what's there and use it as they like. I just ask for appropriate, credit that I actually wrote it. There are also links to other sites for both spiritual wisdom and modern science and the intersection of the two. So BuddhistBrain.com.
And just spell that for people who, for
sure,
some reason, have trouble spelling that.
Buddha, BuddhaHAS. Brain, BRAIN, one long phrase, Buddha's brain.
Okay. We're going to be talking about consciousness for a while, obviously. So since we're going to be using that word that has many meanings, would you please give us your definition of that word?
Yeah. I try to use that word in one of two ways, and be clear which way I'm using it. In the ordinary sense, I, like most academics, let's say, and scientists, use the word really awareness. I mean, and an awareness is a very ordinary thing. I think my cat is aware of a mouse. He's definitely aware when we pop open a can of food for him. In other words, in ways that continue to be mysterious as far as science is concerned, there's a kind of representing of information about the world or information about our own experience in such a way that many parts of the brain can access that information. So I think of awareness as basically a field of information. Some people have called it the global workspace, in which new information comes in, we pull up memories so that we can, have knowledge, and then we go to work on whatever information is there, whether it's, my cat figuring out how to pursue the or go get his cat food, or me, you know, meditating on my breath. So that's the ordinary definition of consciousness for me, awareness, in a very ordinary sense that is shared, I believe, and I think most scientists believe, shared throughout the animal kingdom. Then I think of capital. I'm sorry, go on.
I think you're going to where I was going to ask you. Go ahead.
Oh, okay, fine. Then I think of capital C consciousness, and that I think of as a kind of mysterious, maybe it's mysterious only to me, but to me it's still somewhat profound and sacred and mysterious, a kind of knowing or wakefulness, if you will, that transcends ordinary flesh. And it's possible that ordinary awareness requires in some way capital C consciousness to function. Fundamentally, it's a mystery, even to the most hardcore neuroscientist, exactly how the meat, the brain as it were, produces the mind in terms of conscious experience, aware experience. I mean, the classic example is, how do we see the color red? How do we experience redness or imagine redness in our mind? No one knows how that happens. Nonetheless, there is a growing clarity about the degree to which most ordinary experience, most ordinary mental activity requires and is constrained by and is based on underlying neural activity. So neural activity and mental activity co-arise together, and they influence each other. As the brain changes, so does the mind. And yet, on the other hand, as the mind changes, as we think and feel in different ways, that actually leaves traces behind in neural structure. So it's a two-way street. That's how I think of mind and brain. It's two aspects of one system, one integrated system, co-arising together.
Okay, that's actually my next question. Since we're talking about mind and brain, I'd like your definition of mind, because I have what I call big mind and then what I call little mind.
Right. I suspect my definition of mind is probably pretty close to or the same as the little mind. Most scientists think of the nervous system as, you know, fundamentally processing information. So the nervous system is physical, and it stores and represents and communicates and operates upon non-physical signals, messages, meanings, plans, goals. That entirety of information in the nervous system is what most neuroscientists mean when they use the word mind. Interestingly, most of that information in the nervous system is outside of awareness. For example, how to reach for a cup, or the internal signals that say that it's time to take a slightly deeper breath, or to move food through the intestines, or the ways in which a memory from childhood, let's say, is stored. That kind of information is outside of awareness. We're only aware of the very tip of the iceberg. So in this way of thinking of mind as being defined as all of the information in the nervous system, that means that other than some kind of transcendental spiritual X factor like God, say, or the ground, or the nameless, other than that, fundamentally, the mind is what the brain does. That means that if we do not take good care of our brain, we will harm our mind. On the other hand, if we take action with our mind alone to change our brain for the better, over time we can change our own mind for the better, with lots and lots of benefits for everybody.
Do you, let's see, how do I word this question? Do you believe that causation starts, linguistics is a problem here. So help me if you don't understand, help me say it better. Do you think that causation works from the bottom up or from the top down? And I mean from physical reality up, which would be mostly brain, mind activity, or if it comes from what I call big C consciousness down to little mind and brain. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and it's a deep, deep question. And I'm a complete amateur about this question, although I do have a personal answer, which is informed by what I know as a professional. And so if you're interested in it, you know, with a lot of modesty, I'll offer it. But I consider
I want to hear what you have to say.
Okay, but I mean it very humbly because these are super deep questions. So the way I think of it is that causes, so let's just think about the movement of, you know, the moons of Jupiter, right? Or think about what had the ripples that spread out in a pond if you throw a stone into it. Those causes are material. In other words, they have to do with exchanges of energy, wave patterns. They're very well described within the standard model of physics, and that standard model can describe some pretty wild stuff, like the way that light literally gets bent moving around a gravitational field, or the ways in which two quantum particles can be simultaneously in two different places. One quantum particle can be in two places simultaneously at the same time until there's an observation that makes it appear in one place or another. So there's that part. And as far as animals are concerned that have a nervous system, like human beings, then we have mental phenomena. In other words, flows of information represented in a nervous system in quite material ways, in ordinary ways. But the flows of information impact matter, which can then impact other matter and then impact other fields of information. For example, what I mean by that is that if I'm just sitting or whatever, and I suddenly remember that I forgot to turn off the water in the backyard, the knowing of that is at the level of information. It's at the level of mind. It's not physical. It's the information is represented by a physical substrate, much like a computer hard drive represents not physical meanings of or images or songs, let's say. Well, in the same way, I have this thought, I left the water on. That thought gets my body, which is material, in motion, which then causes me to, let's say, go out and turn off the water, which is, again, material, physical. And then, let's say, my wife, who was watching the water running, wasting money, and is not happy with me, then feels better because finally I turned off the water. So, and her feeling of better is mental. So for me, all of that is happening in a fairly ordinary way. I don't need anything mystical to account, or spiritual, really, to account for any of that so far. Now, here's where I go into the deep end of the pool. I personally think that consciousness is woven into the nature of things. In other words, at any moment in time, the duration of now is infinitely small. So what's happening in that infinitely small interval of now, things are both emerging and passing away and disappearing to make way for the next emergence. At that emergent edge of now, quantum particles, which are the building blocks, really, of everything physical in the universe, as well as, of course, the building blocks of ordinary energy in the universe, because E equals mc squared, well, those quantum particles are only potential. And as quantum mechanics has shown, consciousness is required or seems to be required for quantum potentiality to congeal into quantum actuality and thus form particles like protons and electrons, which then form atoms, which then form, you know, planets and stars and moons.
Sure.
And, you know, the water in my backyard. I think that it's very plausible that consciousness is woven into the nature of everything. So in that sense, consciousness is causal in the sense that it enables materiality to emerge. Beyond that, I do think there are so many examples of uncanny grace, if you will, operating in the world that even as a pretty hard-headed science, business, practical guy kind of guy, I just think of that as evidence. So I think in that sense as well, to me it's highly plausible that in ways that are just mind-blowing to me personally, grace makes its influence known in the material plane.
Okay. That's an interesting answer, and I liked it. Now, for my audience, I have lots of personal questions that I want to ask him. Just that's usually on my list of consciousness questions. So I may not get all to the whole totality of his book, so we may have to do a second interview. Because I have about 20 questions here that about your book, and we hadn't even really gotten started, so I hope you'll come back sometime and let's do those, whatever the ones we miss.
Okay.
My next question is, based on what you just told me, do you believe that we have complete free will? And this is a trick question. Notice I said complete free will. Not free will, but complete free will.
Wow, I think we're moving outside my expertise, you know. That said, could you say a little more, Eva, what you mean by complete free will?
I tell a little story that my teacher taught me one time. We were into like a discussion and we were having a debate, and I said, "That's ridiculous. I can manifest anything that I want." He looked at me and rolled his eyes and said, "Eva, that's ridiculous. You do not have complete free will." It took me 5 years to understand what he said. Now I get it. Imagine yourself driving in the back seat in a car, in a car seat with a little yellow steering wheel, and you're 5 years old. Your God or source or consciousness, whatever you want to call it, mom, is driving in the front seat, and you come up to a four-way stop, and the playground's on the right, and the grocery store's on the left. You get excited because you're going to the playground. But the source driving the car in the front seat is going to the grocery store. Whose steering wheel is going to work?
Right, mom's wheel.
In other words, you know, I hear it all the time. I have free will to do whatever I want.
Yeah, I don't. This is a very tricky one, including from a brain science perspective. And if it's okay with you, I think I'll duck. The way I look at it is that I think that it's very tricky.
If you don't want to answer, it's okay to say pass.
Well, I'll
it's
say it
okay.
like this fundamentally. For one, there are all kinds of forces operating upon us, whether it's mom driving the car or God driving the car, or just what it's like to be born with a certain kind of temperament, or to go through life and you walk in the crosswalk on a green light and a drunk driver comes through and bam, you know, you've got a broken back for 6 months, which blows up your career as a star athlete or whatever. You know, things happen, right? And the question, though, for me a little bit is there even any bit of freedom from determinism, right? Because to me, that's the way I would think about the question of free will. I mean, I'm real clear that I'm subject to so many influences, you know. The Buddha talked about the 10,000 things that affect us at any moment in time, you know, as a kind of metaphor. A deeper question is there any freedom from pure determinism, you know? And I think there is at the quantum level, because there's fundamentally quantum uncertainty. And that kind of fizzy uncertainty woven into the fabric of existence, I think does give us some possibilities of new things happening. But again, boy, I'm really an amateur about this kind of question.
It's all right. I just figured reading your book, you had probably contemplated that at some point in time, and I wanted to hear what you thought.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. And I agree. You know, Bob John's work or Tiller's work has proven that intention can manipulate reality, but it's just subtly.
Uh-huh.
And it's not for sure. You can place the intention and hope it works, and it might to some degree, but you might forget to put the longitude and the latitude in there.
Or as the old saying says, trust in God, but tie your camel.
Right. Okay. Now I want to move to your book.
Okay.
And we have 40 minutes or so.
Uh-huh.
And I have about 16 questions, and they're, as you can probably figure out, I ask questions that require a little bit of talking. So
yeah.
You talk about in your book that your brain basically creates your mind. What do you mean when you say that?
It relates to what I said previously about defining mind as information and a vast quantity of information in the nervous system. So in that meaning of it, the brain or the nervous system broadly, headquartered in the brain, is the physical basis of that information, much as the physical paper and marks on the paper are the basis for the information in a book, like your book, for example. And so in that sense, the brain is the storehouse of information. It's also the computer, in a sense, that operates on the information. Additionally, which is really exciting, the information itself changes the biological machine that's producing it. In other words, as we rest our attention, let's say, on something positive, that actually changes the brain itself. We form a new neural structure based on mental activity. For example, for me it's a funny example that I like, which is London taxi cab drivers who have to memorize the spaghetti snarl of streets in London have to grow, literally, a thicker brain. They grow new synapses, the connections between neurons in their brain, in a part of the brain that does visual spatial memory because they're memorizing the streets. They're working that muscle. Or meditators, people who routinely meditate, develop thicker brain tissue in a couple of key regions. One is a region that's involved in controlling attention and being more mindful because, of course, that's a key part of meditation. And by meditation, I mean here broadly. I would include prayer as well as many other kinds of meditation. Also, meditators develop a thicker brain in a region called the insula, which is involved in tuning into your body and tuning into your own feelings. Because, of course, that's what you're doing in a lot of meditations. You're tracking your body, you're in your body, you're breathing as the body, and you're also tuning into your deep feelings. Those are just a few examples of the ways in which the mind changes the brain. You know, it's a two-way street, which gives us tons of possibility. That's what my book's about, possibilities for using the mind to change the brain for the better.
Okay. I had a question. I lost it. Oh, does the brain think, or does it just process?
The neuroscientist would say, could you tell me the difference between thinking and processing?
Okay.
Not trying to be tricky, just trying to know what you mean.
It's okay. It's a good question. I guess what I mean is, I don't know if you know anything about me, if you looked me up before you...
A little bit. I'm looking at your beautiful website right now.
Oh, thank you. John Markham did that website for me. John Markham Design, he's the most fabulous designer I've ever seen. He's a great guy. Anyway, have to give him credit there. I believe that thinking, you can feel it go across your forehead horizontally, like a ticker tape.
Uh-huh.
I mean, processing, thinking, you know, like that. But when you get, like, a piece of information that you didn't otherwise have, it just kind of drops in drops straight down, like, into a chute, like one of those things that the bank sends their little bank holders in if you're in the drive-in. It just drops into to the top of your head. You didn't think it just came. So that's kind of where I'm trying to figure out, does the brain think those things up and they just come in differently, or you perceive them differently, or does the brain think based on conditioning? Or does it processing a program, our soul or our spirit or our energy field or whatever it is that you want to call it? Linguistics, again, is a problem.
Yeah.
Does that make any sense?
If I follow you right, let's bring it down to earth, because that's what I think is really helpful when tackling big questions, you know, bring them down to earth. So I think about someone walking through a grocery store, all right? We've all done that, of course. We walk through a grocery store, and you're hearing sounds, right? You've got a shopping list. You're scanning the rows. You know kind of where most of where the things are, although maybe not all of it, right? You're seeing objects. You're also checking off against your list. Okay, I got the soup. Still need to get the paper towels. Okay, da-da. In ways that are pretty clear in terms of how sound and sight are processed, the brain is producing those sensations. And also, in ways that are increasingly clear, the brain is producing inner language where you're talking to yourself about still needing to get the paper towels. It's producing the memory that realizes, uh-oh, I forgot to put on, we need more coffee filters, better put that in. The brain's doing that. And the brain is also sitting back and looking at maybe the cost of those coffee filters and thinking, nah, I'm going to get those at the discount grocery store down the street. I think the brain is doing all of that, frankly. And in my own personal opinion,
Wait, I have a question here. Is the brain processing something or thinking something?
I guess I don't.
I mean, if it's processing, it's got to process some information. If it's thinking, it's producing its own information. If it's processing, it's processing information from somewhere else.
Yeah,
Or does it do both?
Would not make that distinction. It's just different order. I think of it as different orders of processing. You know, passively receiving the sight of, you know, someone out of the corner of your eye walking toward you, that's pretty low-level processing. To be thinking in a sophisticated way about getting the kind of coffee that'll please your mate, that's more sophisticated processing. But I think of all that, and that's how neuroscientists generally, there might be some exceptions, but most would think of that as entirely based on information processing in the brain. Some of which is much more sophisticated than other kinds, but it's all information processing.
Okay.
For me, the interesting question, though, is now let's take it out of the grocery store, okay? What if a person is in the grocery store and has a sudden kind of white light experience, or is in the grocery store and gets some kind of deep intuition that they need to rush home immediately, and later, 10 minutes later, half an hour later, they find that it was really wise that they did because their little kid, let's say, is falling over in a little bathtub thing and is drowning, and they came home just in time to save their child or something like that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Then that gets very interesting. I mean, is the ordinary brain, which does a lot of very ordinary processing, at that point, has it received information from some source, in a sense, outside the system, you know, outside the ordinary system that's well-defined by physics and well-understood by physics these days? That's where I think there's a meaningful distinction, you know. And then I think of the brain as potentially, and I want to keep underlining the word potentially, almost like a radio receiver. You know, it can be receiving and working with ordinary information, but then what happens when it's getting information that you cannot explain in any ordinary sort of way? That's really interesting, right?
Yes, it is. And you're making me ask you another question now that I wasn't planning on asking, but I'm going to ask you now. People who have spontaneous spiritual epiphanies or noetic experiences, whatever you want to call it,
mm-hmm.
1 second, they're who they are, Miss Materialist or Miss Ego or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
They blink their eyes, and then suddenly they're wide awake. And what I mean by that is suddenly they see no separation.
Yeah.
Before they saw the world as a duality, and then they blink. Suddenly it's a non-dual world. Where does that come from? Why does that happen? One thing that I found, every single person that, without a doubt, every single person that I've asked this question has had a profound dark night of the soul within approximately 2 years of the event. Do you have any comment about that?
Wow. It rings, well, I would say myself that I've had, well, do you mean like oneness experiences, right?
Excuse me? I can't hear you very well.
Yeah, I'm really loud, so this,
like
I've never...
Like a big bang experience, you know?
Yeah.
Not like just a little thing, but like a big bang.
I think that I wouldn't be able to say much about that, really. I think to myself, I have had very profound unitive experiences, and in the one I'm thinking about, I actually wrote about in the final chapter of my book, you know, just before it happened, I definitely was in a lot of despair. So, and I think you're right. I think there are a lot of stories of people certainly having dark nights of the soul beforehand. Yeah, great. That rings true.
Is there any neuroscience? I mean, something on an MRI or a brain scan, I mean, before and after that you know of?
I doubt there's any sort of research on that. I mean, brain science is a baby science, really, if you think about
yes.
it. And we're just beginning to learn. Now, all this said, really, honestly, I think where there is already, though, a lot of opportunity in brain science is in more ordinary matters. Like, for example, how to calm down the stress response, you know, fear-based system in the body, right? Or how to go through the day and with little positive experiences that everybody, hopefully just about everybody has, actually take them into oneself so they become a part of oneself. Or how to awaken more love in our heart, you know, for our partner or the whole wide world. I mean, there, I think there's a lot more information that's available that's emerging out of the new neuroscience that people can use in daily life.
I think the thing that made me ask you this question is there was a man that visited my house the other day that's an engineer, and he brought me this magazine. I wish I had it in front of me so I could tell you what it was. But I think it was the June issue of Discover or something, and it had a whole bunch of interviews on consciousness. But it was all from a neurological perspective, from heart science. And this man, probably like many others, came away with a completely materialistic perspective, and it made him supportive of his belief that prayer, that there was no God, and I hate to even use that word because of what I really want to say, supported his belief that intention or prayer could not manipulate reality, that everything was simply brain-based. When you die, and that's it. But for people who have had noetic experiences, I just can't imagine that it's a brain function.
Yeah, you're in a territory where it... I'll tell you how I think about it, Eva. I think first, I think it's true that some seemingly spiritual experiences, such as out-of-body experiences, are really based on some kind of hiccup in the brain, all right? Like an epileptic seizure, for example, which is the basis for many out-of-body experiences. So there are ways in which we can, you could say, manipulate the brain to produce some kind of a spiritual experience on the one hand. But what does that actually mean? And I actually have written about this. When people go to my website, they can see some of the stuff that's there. And I wrote an essay. I forget the exact title. I think I called it The Mind, the Brain, and God. Because to me, people who use the fact, like there are dedicated atheists who have an agenda. And it's okay to have an agenda. That's their agenda. But their agenda is to somehow prove that spiritual reality does not exist because the brain is involved in at least some spiritual experiences. But to me, that is a completely unscientific and uneducated, frankly, kind of attempt at proof, because even if the brain is involved, two points here. Point number one, even if there is something that happens in the brain that enables a person to see the oneness of everything. That which they see is true. You know what I mean?
Sure.
So what the brain is involved in seeing what's true, that which is true is true. And how wonderful that something happened in their brain that let them experience that it's all one, right? Suffused maybe with the divine. That's good news. Okay? Point two, fundamentally, if the transcendental, if God or the spirit world exists, by definition, it's distinct from the material realm. It may be entwined with the material realm. It may even be the basis of the material realm. But it's at least conceptually distinct. Otherwise, why use words like spirit or God if all we're talking about is the physical universe? The point is, if there is a God, if there is a spiritual reality, and I personally believe there is, but I'm not going to try to argue it because you can't prove it. I'm not even going to attempt to prove it, because anything that can any apparent proof is in the material realm, and a skeptic could say, well, that's just the material realm. That's just your brain fooling you. Alternately, I could say, look, it's a spiritual reality that's making its way known. It's making itself known in the material realm. So, you know, the bottom line is you can't prove it. So I think attempts to prove it either way, my personal opinion, are not productive, you know. I think what's more useful is to work with the mess we've got in the material realm already, the mess in our body, the mess in our own brain, the mess left over from the crummy childhood maybe we got, the mess that's left over from, you know, our emotional reactions of fear and anger to other people. You know, the mess that's left over by having caveman, cavewoman brains armed with nuclear weapons these days. There's plenty for us to do there. And I also think there's plenty for us to do to open to the divine, which to me is extraordinary, without trying to find proofs of it in quantum mechanics or brain function. That's my two cents.
Good two cents. Interesting. Thank you. All right, we got about 20 minutes. I'm going to read you some of the other questions that I have and let you just pick which ones.
Sure.
Because one of them about gamma, I could ask you questions for 30 minutes. So be careful of that one.
All right.
We're going to have to do another one, but that one really interests me when I think about about gamma waves in the brain and the work that the Pear Lab has done, and the Solaron lamp. I don't know if you know about that, with the random event generator embedded through it in the bottom of it, and it rotates through the electromagnetic spectrum. Do you know about that?
Nope.
Okay. Then we won't even
Sounds cool, though, but keep going.
It's really cool. I might call you back after the show because what you said, like, rang so many bells with me. Okay. What is the relationship between gamma waves and the unity of conscious perception and subjective awareness? Do you think gamma waves bond memory with visual perception? That's one question. I wanted to talk some about virtue, mindfulness, and wisdom. And then how can one's life progressions be seen inside one's brain? I'd like to know that, like for you to discuss dopamine and the natural opioids and, you know, how that affects your life and the way you think and the way you feel. Why does brain detect negative factors faster than positive factors? I.e., why does somebody remember bad things about a person more than maybe good things?
Eva, may I interrupt you?
That's enough. So
that's good. Tell you what, why don't I start in the deep end of the pool with the gamma wave question,
okay?
And then I'll move more to the more...
And we got 20 minutes.
Yeah, I'll keep an eye on the clock here. All right, so gamma waves, for those who don't know, refer to synchronous pulsings of large neural networks 30 to 80 times a second. In other words, imagine neurons spread out around the brain. The brain has 100 billion neurons, all right, and they make about 5,000 connections on average with other neurons, giving us 500 trillion little synapses inside our own brain. Okay, so imagine networks of these neurons, millions and billions of them, firing exactly on time, 30 to 80 times a second, okay? Those are gamma wave, those gamma range brain waves. Okay. The reason this is important, and as you know, Eva, including in the research, is that those brainwave patterns, first, are associated with long-term meditative practice or contemplative practice, broadly defined, prayer, spiritual work of different kinds. People have done a lot of that, and I mean a lot of it. Studies have shown have more resting state gamma wave entrainment of large parts of their brain. And the reason this is important is that if you think about it, since neurons are firing fast, they're firing 5 to 100 times a second typically on the average, if they're only firing 1 to 5 times a second, it's hard for them to hook up with each other and to fire simultaneously, because that's where they form new structure. The famous saying in neuroscience is neurons that fire together wire together, okay? But if they're firing 30 to 80 times a second, there are many more opportunities for them to synchronize and hook up with each other within a single second. And therefore, gamma wave activity in the brain translates in our experience to a sense of unitive consciousness, or what is called in Buddhism traditionally singleness of mind. That's great, because then that gives you a sense of being integrated and whole. And wonderfully, if you like, I can give your listeners two or three practical things they can do that are likely to develop. Okay, that's good. Well, one thing is, try to see if you can be aware of all the sensations of breathing at once in awareness as a single gestalt. Normally what happens if people are mindful of breathing is their attention kind of, the focus shifts from the stomach to the upper lip to the chest, to the lungs, to the nose again, to the stomach, moves around. See if instead of that, if only for a second at a time, and then you'll get better with practice, see if you can be aware of all of the sensations of breathing appearing at once in awareness as a whole. That holistic processing will drive and will support and will stimulate and therefore over time will strengthen these large-scale networks that have a kind of oneness to them in terms of your own experience. And then you can broaden out, after you can do that with the breath, then go to all the body sensations appearing at once, not just those associated with breathing, and then go a step further to all of your experience altogether. Thoughts, emotions, sounds, sights, memories, hopes, dreams, fears, all of it at once appearing in consciousness as a single gestalt. That practice will tend to train your brain in gamma wave entrainment, which is pretty cool.
I have a question here then. There's new information that gut is the second brain.
Yeah.
Is this all happening in the gut too?
I think of it as the nervous system altogether. What I'm talking about there is mostly happening in the cortex, because it's about the conscious, it's working with conscious experience, right? You're aware of the sensation. And it's possible that, both the gut and the cerebellum, which is involved in motor planning, are kind of like extra processing units, as it were. We may be barely aware of what's going on there because most of it is happening unconsciously, but the processing in the cerebellum and maybe even the gut support what's happening in terms of our own awareness.
Okay.
You want me to talk about the negativity bias, why the brain tilts toward negative and what people can do about it?
Sure, that's a good thing.
Yeah, I use this one every day, and it's also helped me understand the mixed-up world we have a lot better. Well, really fast, biological evolution. I'm not talking about spiritual evolution here. The biological evolution has been going on a long time. For example, the nervous system has been evolving for about 600 million years. And during that long run, creatures, animals, plants too, of course, but now I'm just talking about animals, needed to approach rewards and avoid harms. In other words, they needed to approach carrots and avoid sticks. All right? Now, both are important, but if you don't get a carrot today, you'll probably have a chance at a carrot tomorrow. But if you fail to avoid a stick today, whap, no more carrots forever. That's why Mother Nature built into our brain what scientists call a negativity bias. Because rule one in the wild is, you know, eat lunch today, don't be lunch today. So
yeah.
Our ancestors, right, ancestors were animals that were all mellow, super zen, way California where I grew up, super chill. Whap, they got eaten, you know? They weren't noticing all the shadows overhead or the crackle in the brush nearby. The animals that lived to pass on their genes and take care of their young so they could pass on more genes, those animals were anxious. They were paranoid and cranky. They were irritable. And we are their great-great-great-great-great-grandchildren today. So the brain has a negativity bias, and it shows up in lots of ways. If, for example, in the example you gave, if 20 things happen in a day with someone we work with or live with, let's say 10 are positive, 9 are neutral, and 1 is negative, what's the one you think about? It's the negative one, right? Or think about the finding and research on couples, that long-term happy couples need to have at least a 5-to-1 ratio of positive to negative interactions. That means, in effect, that one negative interaction is as powerful as 5 positive ones. Or think about the ways in which, as you go through the day, if a negative thing happens, the brain registers it immediately, stores it for, you know, forever, once burned, twice shy, right? But on the other hand, if you're having a positive experience, unless it's a million-dollar moment, only plain vanilla memory systems are involved, which means that we have to stay with the positive experience 10, 20, 30 seconds in a row for it to move from short-term memory buffers to long-term storage. But how often do we actually do that? Even if we're having positive experiences, we're having them usually a few seconds at a time before they're replaced by another positive experience or by a neutral or negative one. That means that for most of us, positive experiences move through the brain like water through a sieve, but negative experiences are caught every time. That makes the brain like Velcro for negative experiences, but Teflon for positive ones. That's the natural, unfortunate default setting of the brain. It's a great way to keep animals alive in the wild and protect their young, but it's a lousy way to have quality of life, and it's lousy for spiritual growth. That's why, for me, it's so important to, among other ways, take charge of this brain we've got by deliberately, in one example here, taking in the good. In other words, half a dozen times a day, at least, when little good things happen, help yourself take 30 seconds with them so you really feel them, so you stay with them and get those neurons firing together so they start wiring together and weaving this positive experience into the fabric of your brain and your whole being. This is a great method for people who are anxious or depressed, and also for people just in life altogether. It's also great for spiritual practice. I think how often we have spiritual realizations or spiritual experiences, but they don't stick to our ribs, you know? We get up from the meditation cushion or whatever, and then an hour later or a week later, it's as if nothing happened. That's because we did not help it transfer into long-term storage so that we could cultivate it inside our mind, you know? I also think for children, it's so important to help them. Maybe just before bed, if they'll put up with some psychobabble to extend their bedtime, you know, or maybe just talking with them or teaching them this method. It's so important for kids, too, to deliberately take in good experiences to build up resources inside themselves.
That's a great idea. That makes me think of another thing you said in your book. You said, have compassion for yourself.
Yeah.
And I went through those sentences and I thought, you know, that's a very hard thing to differentiate between compassion and self-pity.
Great.
So how do you tell people how to do that?
That's great. So compassion, in the way I mean it, is the wish that a being not suffer, usually combined with a feeling of sympathetic concern. But fundamentally, it's a wish, which I actually like because it's kind of a low bar. At least I wish them well. I wish that they not suffer. I won't name any political names here or recent occupants of, you know, high office, but you can wish someone well while also believing that justice should be served and they belong in jail, you know? And mm-hmm. so that's the simple thing. Now, here's the thing. Compassion is for all beings, including the one who wears your own name tag. And there's in psychology, there's a term, negative grandiosity. It's the idea that you are so uniquely special that you, of all people on the planet, do not deserve the happiness that others deserve, right? So we should be compassionate for ourselves, both out of kindness to ourselves and out of practical self-interest, because many studies have shown that compassion for oneself is a very important factor for resilience and happiness and positive emotion. Now, the distinction between self-compassion and self-pity is the purpose. If the purpose is to feel your own pain with support and empathy, and then on the basis of that, get up off the ground and go, you know, take care of your problems, that's self-compassion. On the other hand, if the purpose is to just kind of wallow in woe is me, nothing I can do, why don't they help me, blah-de-blah-de-blah, that's self-pity. You know, the way I mean self-compassion and the way it's usually meant, you know, in the research that's on it these days, is that it's the beginning, not the end. It's the beginning of skillful and resourceful action. It's not about passivity.
Okay. Still seems like a hard thing for somebody that's actually in the dark night to distinguish between compassion and self-pity. Having been there, now I can see it, but in the middle of it.
Yeah, sorry to interrupt you. But pity is a beautiful thing. You know, I pity the poor people in Norway who were shot, or their families of people who've been killed. Why not pity ourselves, you know what I mean, to an extent? I think the distinction is, I think sometimes the truth is, the only thing we can do is to have compassion for ourselves. And at least we can do that, though. And what's so wrong about being compassionate for oneself, you know, for many minutes in a row? I don't think that's so bad, my own opinion here, I guess.
I don't think it is either. It's just that when I review it, remembering being in a dark night.
Yeah.
I don't know. Anyway, you've got about 5 minutes. I want to give you time to talk about whatever you want to talk about.
Oh, thank you. Well, if I could say this, Eva, having looked at your photograph on your website, you're a beautiful person. So I just want to talk about that for at least 10 seconds worth.
Thank you.
And obviously doing a lot of good things in the world for lots and lots of people here. I guess the thing I would just like to say, and then feel free to jump in, please, is that I look out at the world, and I've been a guy for 35 years now in human potential, spiritual practice, and, you know, conventional Western clinical psychology. And one thing I see looking out at the world and talking with people day in and day out is a lot of people feel pretty, in effect, pushed around by, you know? Still there?
You broke up. You
yeah, I'll
around.
Just say it again, yeah. A lot of people, I think, feel pushed around. And I'm happy to discover increasingly that there are things we can actually do. We can take action inside our own mind to make ourselves better. And I think that's such a wonderful thing to appreciate, that you can actually take action, you know, now increasingly supported by science, that will change your brain for the better. Like, to me, that's very hopeful and very important, you know, for people to know.
Absolutely. Tell us one more time where to find you before we hang
sure.
up.
Sure. Buddhasbrain.com. Buddhasbrain.com will take you to my website. The book's on Amazon. It's everywhere, actually. It's done very well. It's been out almost 2 years, and it's still doing great. I'm very happy about that. It's in 21 languages. Can you believe that?
And you're Dr. Rick Hansen, Hansson.
That's right, neuropsychologist. That's right.
Thank you, Rick. It's been
also a
great show.
Teacher.
I thoroughly enjoyed it.
A lot of meditation, too. But thank you, Eva.
It's been my pleasure. I enjoyed it. Have a good evening.
Okay, you too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Hi, this is Elliot Dasher, author of Integral Health.
Integral Health. Integral Health.
You can hear me and others speaking about consciousness and health.
Consciousness and health.
Consciousness and health. Just tune in every Sunday evening at 7 p.m.
7 p.m.
to Infinite Consciousness with Eva Herr.